The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, welcome you all. My name's Ying. Good to see you all on Saturday morning. And so last few months, I've been kind of reflecting and studying and a set of suttas. Suttas are kind of ancient texts that recorded a lot of teachings from the Buddha's times. The Buddha's teachings or his disciples' teachings. And a particular set of suttas that I've been reading is about his son, Rahula. So how many of you have heard about the stories of Buddha's son? And some of you have. Yeah. So today what's on my mind is to kind of share a little bit about the teachings that he gave to his son when he was 18. And in the middle-length discourses, there are three prominent suttas that talked about Rahula and what the Buddha taught to his son, Rahula. And I'll kind of, maybe some of this is going to be a little bit of a repeat for those who knew the story. But maybe there's some new perspectives that you hear. And then we'll focus on the teachings that he gave to his son when he was 18 today. And so it was said that a Buddha left the palace on the night when his son was born. And so this newborn is there, and the same night, Buddha left the palace and left his wife, his son, and his parents. And it was said that he left without seeing Rahula's face. And the commentary was saying the mother had her arm kind of covering the little baby's face, and Buddha didn't quite see the face, and he left. And I suspect that, you know, if he did see the face, maybe he would not be able to go. And, you know, Buddha was supposed to be a very compassionate individual, and it's probably not easy for him. But he did leave. He left, wandered quite far away for 6 years, learning various forms of teachings and practices. And he had deep states of concentration, and he spent quite some time doing ascetic practices, you know, not eating much and almost nothing at all, almost died. And then he realized this is not working, and so he had to take a moderate middle way. And then he became the Buddha after 6 years old, 6 year old. After 6 year. And after that, he did not forget his family. And so for a year, he wandered on foot back to his hometown. And then at that time, he also had some disciples following him as well. But he did come back home to his hometown. And that's when Rahula is 7 year old at that time. And so when he first saw, when the mother first saw the Buddha is coming back, and he asked Rahula to ask the Buddha for inheritance or heritage. And when that request was given to the Buddha, Buddha ordained the Rahula as a novice monk, out of a surprise of the grandparents. You know, they all thought Buddha would give, make him king, because that was the kingdom. But Buddha did something different. He ordained the little Rahula, 7 year old, as a novice monk. And then Shortly after, I think not long after Rahula was ordained, and the first sutta in one of the first suttas about Rahula was documenting a teaching that the Buddha gave to this 7-year-old. And the commentary said that there was an incident where Rahula had lied. And, you know, you can imagine 7-year-old, they did something, you ask them, did you do this? No. This is roughly not uncommon for the little kid to do that. But the father was going to teach him something. And so the first sutta about the Rahula documented and the teaching about truthfulness and mindfulness. And Buddha taught him in a very, I found a way, very unique way. And so when he taught Rahula about the truthfulness, he really tried to have Rahula understand the consequence. And he told Rahula, and he did tell Rahula very directly, don't lie. But also he said, well, for those who lies and have no regret when lying, there's no evil they would not do. And imagine, you know, Rahula as a 7-year-old ordained in the monastic, probably had under a lot of influence knowing to abide in skillful behavior. And so this was said, must have kind of have just kind of hit on his head, and wow. And then after that, and the Buddha gave a very interesting and I would imagine age-appropriate teaching to Rahula about how to be mindful of his actions. His actions that include bodily, verbal, and mental actions. And so he asked him, you should reflect and contemplate before you take any actions, or during the actions, or after you've taken actions, whether the activity will lead to harm in yourself and others, or both, or whether that'll lead to the benefit of yourself, others, or both. And you do that every time an action is going to be taken. And you do it before, during, and after. And that was quite significant because I reflected, I have a 10-year-old, and it's hard for me to imagine, you know, a 10-year-old to really sit down and meditate. It won't work. Or 7-year-old. And then so, but if they are able to follow the instructions of what the Buddha taught in terms of reflecting, and they probably will become very mindful as they, you know, go about doing things in the day. If they really can reflect before, during, and after, right? And that's kind of a very skillful way of cultivating mindfulness for the little kids. And so so that's the kind of the first teaching that was given to Rahula that's documented in the Middle Length Discourse. And then, fast forward, this is to this second one, and which is what we'll focus on today, is that Rahula is said to be about 18-year-old at this time. We don't know for sure, and that's what the commentary was pointing out. This is kind of young adult, still a teenager. But I suspect that it's the time when Rahula is ripe for meditative practice. And it was said that he was meditating when the sutta began. And so there's not a whole lot of being said what happened in between. And so I would imagine, you know, Rahula has been living in the monastic order and probably practicing a bit, quite a lot already. And so this is one day, and Buddha got up from his sitting in the morning. He put on the ropes and took Om's ball and is about to go into the town to get Om's food. Now, Rahula also got up. His son also got up. And so he took the ball and followed the Buddha right behind him. And so you have to imagine this a little bit because Buddha was said to be a radiant individual. You know, he has this 32 marks of, you know, some really special man, right? A special individual. And he must be a very radiant kind of handsome and authoritative figure. And then Rahula, being his son, 18-year-old, I suspect, you know, it's also a very handsome young man. And following the authoritative figure, a monastic leader, and happens to be his father. And he's following him right behind. And so he may have this moment of the thinking, look at me. So Buddha might have read his mind a little bit. And so he looked back at Rahula and said to him, so he said, Rahula, you should truly see any kind of a form at all, past, future, or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, all form with the right understanding. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. So he kind of just turned around and looked at Rahula and said, all forms really refer to material form, and you know, our bodies. You know, if Rahula has some sort of attachment to his beauty and handsomeness or youth, and there might be certain attachment identifying this as my body, you know, me, this is who I am. And so Buddha just turned around and said, you should have a right understanding about this, and this is not mine, I am not this, and this is not myself. And then Rahula asked, only form, blessed one? And the Buddha said, form, Rahula, also feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And so these five things, forms, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are known as five aggregates that we oftentimes identify them as who we are. I am this, you know, I'm this bundle of body or feelings, you know, this is I am, this is who I am. But Buddha told him to have a right understanding on this and look at this differently. This is not mine, I'm not this, and this is not myself. And so I imagine that Rahula probably knew this teaching a bit already, previously. And so he probably felt bad. So he thought, well, who would still go for alms food when you get advised by the Buddha directly like this? So he turned back and he sat under the tree and started meditating. And so Venerable Sariputta, this is one of the Buddha's primary disciples, saw Rahula sitting under the tree. And so he came and addressed Rahula. He said, Rahula, develop mindfulness of breathing. When mindfulness of breathing is cultivated and developed, it is of great fruit and benefit. And so he just said this, and then he left. And based on the sutta, it feels like maybe Rahula hasn't really been exposed to mindfulness of breathing up to that point, because later on, the Buddha had given a longer explanation of what this is. And so, but he continued to sit. Now, we don't know what exactly he was meditating on. We don't know what, you know, was taught in between. But later in the afternoon, he got up from the meditation, and then he went to see the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha, "Sir, how is mindfulness of breathing when cultivated and developed to be of great fruit and a benefit?" And so it seems to me that he didn't quite understand what the Sariputta was saying. And now the rest of the sutta, the Buddha began to kind of approaching answering this question that Rahula posted. But it's also interesting to see that the Buddha didn't quite directly answer the question right away. And he first kind of gave extended teachings on several other things. And I suspect that this is kind of preparing Rahula to be ready to receive this teaching around mindfulness breathing. And the first set that he gave to Rahula maybe still related to how Rahula might be attached to his body, you know, as a young, handsome young man. And so the Buddha again, directed Rahula to see his body in terms of elements. And so there are five elements being described here. The elements are really kind of elementary components of our bodies. And so that includes earth, water, fire, air, and space. And so he directed the Rahula to look at earth as earth. And the earth can be a sense of solidity, and the water can be sense of fluidity, air can be a sense of movements, and fire, sense of a temperature. And he kind of have a detailed explanation of each of this, and look at in this elementary level, kind of with the detailed sensitivity to it, and look at these five elements as they are based on the felt sense of all of this. And then also perceive this with the right understanding that all of these elements, this is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. He's asking Rahula to train his mind in a particular perception, to see this body not as I mean mine. You know, that's kind of a Buddha's instruction. And then when that teaching was given, and then he encouraged Rahula to meditate on earth, water, fire, air, and space in a very equanimous mode. And so I suspect that, you know, when the mind began to balance a bit, you know, not to hold onto it as I mean mine, but also not aversive to it, the mind can begin to settle into equanimity. And so he trains Rahula to meditate on earth, not grasping or being aversive. And so he says, "Rahula, meditate like earth. When you meditate like the earth, pleasant and unpleasant contact will not occupy your mind." And so he used some analogy here. Suppose they were to toss both clean and unclean things on the earth, like urine, spit, pus, and blood. The earth isn't horrified, repelled, or disgusted because of this. In the same way, meditate like the earth. For when you meditate like the earth, pleasant and unpleasant contact will not occupy your mind. And so meditate like earth, kind of have this felt sense of the vast earth underneath of us, that we're not reactive to the pleasant, unpleasant sensations that might be coming, or we're not reactive to the big sound outside, kind of, you know, are not getting pulled by our sense contacts. And similarly, meditate like a water, you know, vast body of water. And no matter what you throw into it, you can stay equanimous, not being compulsive about it. And so that's the second piece of the instruction that was given to Rahula. And that is to meditate like all this vastness of the elements. You know, that's kind of my interpretation. But stability of all of this. And then after that, the Buddha went on to ask Rahula to meditate on four Brahma Viharas to counter ill will, cruelty, negativity, and repulsion. And also meditate on ugliness to counter lust, and meditate on impermanence to remove conceit of I am. And that's a whole long list of practices the Buddha had given to Rahula before he kind of started doing mindfulness of breath. And I want to just pause for a moment to see if you have any questions or comments at this point. I was amazed to see how much the Buddha had said up to this point to his son. Anyone have a comment or question?
A list of 24 items is the longest list the Buddha made.
And I suspect there is probably a reason for Buddha kind of laying it out this way when teach Rahula. Maybe he understands certain things that are going on in Rahula's practice or his mindset. And he had to give a whole long list before he got to the 16 steps of Anapanasati, to mindfulness of breath. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah. After all of that, and he now began to tell Rahula how mindfulness of breath is developed, and it's of great benefit and fruit. And I was also somewhat surprised to see, but also it was very sweet to see that the Buddha didn't quite answer in answer this question in terms of, you know, what is the fruit and the benefit, but rather this 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, when you begin to develop this itself, is of a benefit. This practice itself is the benefit and a fruit. Because each of the steps, some of you might be familiar with it, and there are what's called four tetrads, and each tetrad has four steps in it. And when you develop this, our overall system go through the process of being calmed through this practice. Our body began to calm and settle, and our mind began to settle and calm, and our mind began to be free from a lot of hindrances or other things that might affect us. And then the last of four steps, it leads to deep sense of letting go. And it's said the last step is relinquishment, kind of some deep sense, complete sense of letting go. And so that itself is the benefit, is the fruit of this practice. And so what the Buddha did was to give this 16 steps of instruction, you know, as the instruction unfolds. And I get this sense that this itself, just practicing this, is fruitful and beneficial. And no need for any other reason to do it. And so, so Buddha went on at that point. He began to give the instruction on 16 steps of Anapanasati. And maybe I'll just read the steps a little bit, and you can listen to it if you like to kind of feel the meditative aspect of it. You know, feel free to do so if you like to kind of make this a part of the meditation or being meditative. When breathing in heavily, one knows I'm breathing in heavily. When breathing out heavily, one knows I'm breathing out heavily. When breathing in lightly, one knows I'm breathing in lightly. When breathing out lightly, one knows I'm breathing out lightly. The practice, breathing in, experiencing the whole body. They practice breathing out, experiencing the whole body. They practice breathing in, stilling the body's motion. They practice breathing out, stilling the body's motion. They practice breathing, experiencing rapture. They practice breathing out, experiencing rapture. They practice breathing in, experiencing bliss. They practice breathing out, experiencing bliss. They practice breathing in, experiencing these emotions. They practice breathing out, experiencing these emotions. They practice breathing in, stilling these emotions. They practice breathing out, stilling these emotions. They practice breathing in, experiencing the mind. They practice experiencing out. They practice breathing out, experiencing the mind. They practice breathing in, experiencing gladdening of the mind. They practice breathing out, experiencing gladdening of the mind. They practice breathing in, immersing the mind. They practice breathing out, immersing the mind. They practice breathing in, freeing the mind. They practice breathing out, experiencing freezing of the mind. They practice breathing in, observing impermanence. They practice breathing out, observing impermanence. They practice breathing in, observing fading away. They practice breathing out, observing fading away. We practice breathing in, observing cessation. We practice breathing out, observing cessation. We practice breathing in, observing letting go. We practice breathing out, observing letting go. These 16 steps, when you progressively develop, it really settles the mind and settles the body and then lead to this kind of deep sense of letting go. And the sutta ended with this statement. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated in this way, even when the final breath in and out cease, they are known, not unknown. I guess this knowing the last breath until it ceases has quite a significant quite a significance in that culture, and probably in our culture too. There's a saying about dying with alertness, and maybe it's also because dying process can be a secret process. And maybe when that process is clearly known, not unknown, it can be an opportunity for awakening as well. And so when this practice is done repeatedly, and then going with our breathing in and out, and that can be the opportunity to know this even for our last breath. And so that's the second sutta, and that was given when Rahula was 18. So now pause and see if there's any comments and questions and thoughts that might have occurred. Well, if not, then this is it for today. So thank you so much for coming.